the Vronskys, through whom she had her information, who hoped through her influence to obtain a concession, told her that they had finished their affairs and were leaving Petersburg next day. Lydia Ivanovna was beginning to breathe freely again when next morning she received a note and with horror recognized the handwriting. It was Anna Karenina's. The envelope was as thick as parchment. There was a large monogram on the narrow yellow sheet, and the letter had a delicious perfume.
"Who brought it?"
"A commissionaire from the hotel." It was some time before the Countess Lydia Ivanovna could sit down to read the letter. Her agitation brought on a fit of asthma to which she was subject. When she grew calmer, she read the following, written in French. "Madame la Comtesse, the Christian feelings which fill your heart encourage me to what I feel to be the unpardonable boldness of writing to you. I am unhappy at being parted from my son. I entreat you to permit me to see him once before my departure. Forgive me for reminding you of myself. I address myself to you instead of to Alexei Alexandrovich, only because I do not wish to give pain to that high-minded man by reminding him of myself. Knowing your friendship for him, I feel that you will understand me. Will you send Seretse to me, or shall I come to the house at an appointed time, or will you let me know when and where I can meet him away from home? I do not anticipate a refusal, knowing the magnanimity of the person on whom the decision depends. You cannot imagine the yearning I have to see him, and therefore cannot imagine the gratitude which your help will awaken in me. Anna." Everything in that letter irritated the Countess Lydia Ivanovna. Its matter, the hint contained in the word magnanimity, and especially what seemed to her its free and easy tone.
"Say there will be no answer," said the Countess Lydia Ivanovna, and at once opened her blotter and wrote to Karenin that she hoped to meet him about 1 o'clock at the palace at the birthday reception. "I must talk over an important and sad matter with you, and we can arrange where. Best of all at my house, where I will have your special tea ready. It is necessary. He sends a cross, but he also sends strength to bear it," she added, to prepare him somewhat. The Countess Lydia Ivanovna generally wrote 2 or 3 notes a day to Karenin. She liked that way of communicating with him, which had an elegance and secrecy absent in their personal interviews.
Chapter 24. The congratulations at the palace were over. Meeting as they were going out, acquaintances chatted about the latest news, the newly awarded honours, and the changes among the highest officials.
"How would it do to appoint Countess Maria Borisovna, Minister of War, and Princess Vatkovskaya, Chief of the Staff?" said a grey-haired old man in a gold-embroidered uniform to a tall and beautiful maid of honour, in answer to her question about the promotions.
"And me, aide-de-camp," replied the maid of honour with a smile.
"Your post is already assigned to you, in the ecclesiastical department, with Karenin as your assistant." "How do you do, Prince?" added the old man, shaking hands with someone who had just come up.
"What were you saying about Karenin?" inquired the prince.
"He and Putyatov have received the Order of Alexander Nevsky."
"I thought he had it already."
"No, just look at him," said the old man, pointing with his gold-trimmed hat to Karenin, who, in court uniform with a new red ribbon round his shoulder, stood in the doorway with an important member of the State Council. "As happy and contented as a brass farthing," he added, pausing to shake hands with an athletic, handsome chamberlain.
"No, he has aged," said the chamberlain,
"from hard work. He is always writing projects now. He will not release that unfortunate fellow until he has expounded everything, point by point."
"Aged, indeed. Il fait des passions. I think that now the Countess Lydia Ivanovna is jealous of his wife."
"Oh, come, please don't say anything bad about the Countess."
But is it bad that she is in love with Karenin?
And is it true that his wife is here?
Of course, not here in the palace, but she is in Petersburg. I met her and Alexei Vronsky walking arm in arm on the Morskaya.
C'est un homme qui n'a pas...
began the chamberlain, but stopped short to make way for and to bow to a member of the imperial family who passed by. In this way they chattered unceasingly about Karenin, blaming him and laughing at him, while he, barring the way to the member of the State Council whom he had buttonholed, and not pausing for a moment for fear he might slip away, expounded point by point some financial project of his. Almost at the same time that his wife had left Karenin, the most painful thing that can befall an official, the cessation of his ascent in the service, had befallen him. That cessation was an accomplished fact, clearly visible to everyone, though Karenin himself had not yet realized that his career was at an end. Whether it was his conflict with Stremov or the misfortune with his wife, or simply that he had reached his predestined limit, at any rate it had that year become obvious to everyone that his career was over. He still held an important post, was member of many commissions and committees, but he was finished, and from him nothing further was to be looked for. Whatever he might say, whatever he might propose, he was listened to as if all he was proposing had long been known and was what no one wanted. But Karenin was not sensible of this. On the contrary, being now outside government work, he saw more clearly than ever the defects and mistakes made by others, and considered it his duty to point out how those mistakes might be rectified. Soon after the parting with his wife, he began writing a pamphlet on the new legal procedure, the first of an innumerable series of unwanted pamphlets on every administrative department which it was his fate to write. But Karenin, far from noticing the hopelessness of his position in officialdom and being troubled by it, was more satisfied with his work than ever. He that is married careth for the things that are of the world, how he may please his wife. But he that is unmarried careth for the things that belong to the Lord, and how to please the Lord, says the Apostle Paul. And Karenin, who was now guided in all his actions by the Scriptures, often recalled that text. He thought that since he had been without a wife, he had served the Lord by means of these very projects more than before. The evident impatience of the member of the council did not trouble Karenin, who left off expounding his project only when the councillor, profiting by a royal personage's passing, slipped away. Left alone, Karenin bowed his head, collecting his thoughts, and then turned absent-mindedly toward the door where he hoped to meet the Countess Lydia Ivanovna. "How strong and healthy they all are, physically," he thought, glancing at the powerfully built chamberlain with his well-brushed and perfumed whiskers, and at the red neck of a prince in a tightly fitting uniform, whom he had to pass on his way. "It is truly said that everything in the world is sin," he thought, again glancing out of the corners of his eyes at the chamberlain's calves. Moving his feet deliberately, Karenin, with his usual air of weariness and dignity, bowed to those gentlemen who were talking about him, and his eyes searched through the doorway for the Countess.
"Ah, Alexei Alexandrovich!" cried the old man with a malevolent gleam in his eyes as Karenin passed him, bowing coldly.
"I have not yet congratulated you," he went on, pointing to Karenin's newly awarded ribbon.
"Thank you," replied Karenin. "What a beautiful day it is," he added, laying, as was his wont, peculiar stress on the word beautiful. He knew that they were laughing at him, but he no longer looked for anything except hostility from them. He was already accustomed to it.
Having caught sight, just as she entered, of the Countess Lydia Ivanovna's yellow shoulders emerging from her corset, and of her beautiful, dreamy eyes summoning him, Karenin smiled, revealing his white, impeccable teeth, and went up to her. Lydia Ivanovna's dress had cost her a great deal of trouble, as was the case with all her attire of late. Her purpose in dressing was now quite the reverse of what she had had in view 30 years ago. Then she had wished to adorn herself somehow, the more the better. Now, on the contrary, she was obliged to be adorned so unsuitably to her age and figure that she was only concerned that the incongruity between these adornments and her own appearance should not be too dreadful. As far as Karenin was concerned, she attained her object, and to him she seemed attractive. In his eyes, she was the only islet, not of kindly feeling only, but of affection, in the ocean of hostility and ridicule which surrounded him. As he now ran the gauntlet of those mocking eyes, he was drawn toward her enamored look as naturally as a plant is drawn toward the sun. "I congratulate you," she said, indicating the ribbon by a look. Repressing a smile of pleasure, he shrugged his shoulders and closed his eyes, as if to say that it could not give him pleasure. The Countess Lydia Ivanovna knew very well that it was one of his greatest pleasures, though he would never confess it. "How is our angel?" asked she, meaning Seretse.
"I can't say I am quite satisfied with him," replied Karenin, raising his eyebrows and opening his eyes. "And Sitnikov, too, is dissatisfied with him."
Sitnikov was the tutor to whom Seretse's secular education was entrusted.
"As I told you, he shows a certain coldness toward those most important questions which should stir the soul of every man and child," he went on, speaking on the only subject which interested him outside the service, the education of his son. When, with Lydia Ivanovna's help, he had returned to life and activity, he had felt it his duty to take his son's education in hand. Never having occupied himself with educational matters before, he devoted some time to studying the matter theoretically. After reading several books on anthropology, pedagogics, and didactics, he formed a plan of education, and having engaged the best Petersburg educationalist for supervision, he set to work. And this undertaking occupied him continually.
"Yes, but his heart. I see in him his father's heart, and with such a heart a child can't be bad," said Lydia Ivanovna enthusiastically.
"Perhaps. Well, as far as I am concerned, I do my duty, which is all I can do."
"Will you come and see me?" said the Countess, after a pause. "We must talk over something painful to you. I would have given anything to save you from certain memories, but other people think differently. I had a letter from her. She is here in Petersburg."
Karenin started at the reference to his wife, but immediately his face assumed a death-like immobility which showed utter helplessness in the matter. "I expected it," he said. The Countess Lydia Ivanovna looked at him ecstatically, and her eyes filled with tears of rapturous admiration at the loftiness of his soul.
Chapter 25. When Karenin entered the Countess Lydia Ivanovna's snug little boudoir, which was full of old china and had its walls covered with portraits, the hostess was not yet there. She was changing her dress. Upon a round table covered with a cloth stood a Chinese tea service and a silver kettle over a spirit lamp. Karenin glanced absent-mindedly at the numberless familiar portraits decorating the boudoir, and sitting down by the table, opened a New Testament that was on it. The rustle of the Countess's silk dress roused him.
"Well, now we can sit down quietly," said she with an agitated smile as she squeezed herself in between the table and sofa, "and have a chat over our tea."
After a few words of preparation, the Countess, breathing heavily and blushing, handed him the letter she had received. When he had read the letter, Karenin was silent for a long time.
"I don't consider that I have a right to refuse," he said timidly, raising his eyes.
"My dear friend,
You see no evil in anyone.
On the contrary, I see that everything is evil. But is it right? His face expressed uncertainty and a desire for advice, support, and guidance in a matter he did not understand.
No, she interrupted him. There are limits to everything.
I understand immorality, she said, not quite sincerely, for she never could have understood that which leads women to immorality. But I do not understand cruelty.
And to whom?
To you.
How can she stay in the town you are in?
But it's quite true. Live and learn. And I am learning to understand your loftiness and her baseness. But who will throw the stone? Said he, evidently pleased with his role. I have quite forgiven her, and therefore cannot refuse her what her love for her son demands.
But is it love, dear friend? Is it sincere? Granted that you have forgiven her and do forgive her, but have we the right to act thus toward the soul of that angel?
He thinks she is dead. He prays for her and asks God to forgive her her sins, and it is better so.
But this, what will he think?
I had not thought of that, said Karenin, evidently agreeing with her. The Countess covered her face with her hands and remained silent. She was praying. If you ask my advice, she said when her prayer was ended and she uncovered her face, I do not advise you to do it.
Do I not see how you are suffering, how this has reopened all your wounds?
Of course, as usual, you are not thinking of yourself.
But what can it lead to?
Renewed pain for yourself and pain for the child. If there is anything human left in her, she herself should not desire it. No, I advise you unhesitatingly not to allow it, and with your permission I will write to her. Karenin agreed, and the Countess Lydia Ivanovna wrote in French as follows. Madame, to remind your son of you might lead to his asking questions which it would be impossible to answer without implanting in his soul a spirit of condemnation for what should be holy to him. And therefore I beg you to take your husband's refusal in the spirit of Christian love. I pray the Almighty to be merciful to you. Countess Lydia. This letter achieved the secret purpose which the Countess Lydia Ivanovna hid even from herself. It wounded Anna to the depths of her soul. Karenin, too, on returning home from Lydia Ivanovna's, could not give his attention to his usual occupations, nor find that spiritual peace of a believer who has found salvation which he had felt before. The memory of his wife, who was so guilty toward him and toward whom he was so saintly, as the Countess Lydia Ivanovna had justly told him, should not have upset him. But he was not at ease. He could not understand the book he was reading, could not drive away tormenting memories of his relations with her, and of the mistakes which, as it now appeared to him, he had committed in regard to her. The memory of the manner in which, when returning from the races, he had received her confession of unfaithfulness, especially the fact that he had demanded of her only external propriety and had not challenged Vronsky, tormented him like remorse. The memory of the letter he had written to her also tormented him. Above all, his forgiveness, which no one wanted, and his care for another man's child, burnt his heart with shame and regret. He now felt a similar sense of shame and remorse when thinking of his whole past with her, and recalling the awkward words in which, after much hesitation, he had proposed to her. But wherein am I to blame? He asked himself, and as usual that question suggested another. Did those others, those Vronskys and Oblonskys and those fat-carved Chamberlains feel differently, love differently, marry differently. And there rose before his mind's eye a whole row of those vigorous, strong, self-assured men who had always involuntarily attracted his curiosity and attention. He drove these thoughts from him and tried to convince himself that he was not living for the present temporal life, but for eternal life, and that his soul was full of peace and love. But the fact that in this temporary, insignificant life he had committed, as it seemed to him, some trivial errors, tormented him as much as if the eternal salvation in which he believed did not exist. But this temptation did not last long, and soon that tranquil elevation, thanks to which he could forget the things he did not wish to remember, was re-established in his soul. Chapter 26.
"Well, Kapitonich," said Tseretse, as on the day before his birthday he returned rosy and bright from a walk, and gave his overcoat to the tall old hall porter, who looked smilingly down from his height at the little fellow. "Well, has the bandaged official been today? Has Papa seen him?"
"He has seen him. As soon as the secretary left, I announced him," answered the hall porter with a wink. "Let me take it off for you."
"Tseretse,"
said his tutor, a Slav, stopping in the doorway that led to the inner rooms,
"take it off yourself."
But Tseretse, though he heard his tutor's weak voice, paid no heed to it. He stood holding on by the porter's shoulder strap and looking into his face.
"Well, and has Papa done what he wanted?"
The hall porter nodded affirmatively. The bandaged official, who had called seven times to petition Karenin about something, interested both Tseretse and the hall porter. Tseretse had met him in the hall, and had heard him piteously begging the porter to announce him to Karenin, and saying that he and his children were face to face with death. Since then, having again met the official in the hall, Tseretse had become interested in him.
"And was he very glad?" he asked.
"How could he help being glad? He nearly jumped for joy as he went away."
"And has anything been brought?" inquired Tseretse, after a pause.
"Well, sir," said the porter, shaking his head and whispering, "there is something from the Countess."
Tseretse knew at once that the hall porter was speaking of a birthday present for him from the Countess Lydia Ivanovna.
"You don't say so! Where is it?"
"Corneille has taken it into your papa. I should think it's a fine thing."
"What size? About so big?"
"Not quite, but a fine thing."
"A book?"
"No, just a thing."
"Go, go! Vasily Lukitch is calling you," said the hall porter, hearing the approaching step of the tutor,
and gently disengaging the little hand in the half-drawn-off glove which held him by his shoulder-strap, as he nodded and winked toward the tutor.
"Vasily Lukitch, one moment," said Tseretse,
with that bright and affectionate smile which always overcame the conscientious Vasily Lukitch. Tseretse was in too high spirits, too happy not to share with his friend the hall-porter another family joy about which he had heard from Lydia Ivanovna's niece, whom he met walking in the summer gardens. This joy appeared to him particularly important because it coincided with the satisfaction of the official, and his own happiness that a present had been brought. To Tseretse it seemed that this day was one on which everybody ought to be happy and gay.
"Do you know Papa has received the Order of Alexander Nevsky?"
"Of course I do. People have already been calling to congratulate him."
"Well, and is he pleased?"
"How can he help being pleased at the Tsar's favour?" "It shows he's deserved it," replied the hall porter, sternly and seriously.
Tseretse grew thoughtful as he peered into the hall porter's face, which he had studied in minute detail, especially the chin which hung beneath the grey whiskers, and which no one saw but Tseretse, who always looked up at him.
"And your daughter, has she been here lately?" The hall porter's daughter was a ballet dancer.
How can she come on weekdays? They have to learn, too, and so must you, sir. Go along.
On entering the schoolroom, instead of sitting down to his lessons, Sir Etzer told his tutor of his guess that the parcel that had been brought must be a railway train.
What do you think?
He asked. But Vasily Lukitch only thought that Sir Etzer must prepare his grammar lesson, as his teacher was coming at 2.
Oh, but just tell me, Vasily Lukitch, said Sir Etzer suddenly, after sitting down at the table with a book in his hand. What is higher than the Alexander Nevsky? You know Papa has received the Order of Alexander Nevsky.
Vasily Lukitch replied that the Order of Vladimir was higher.
And higher still?
The highest is the St. Andrew.
And higher still?
I don't know.
Even you don't know?
And Sir Etzer, leaning his elbows on the table, began to reflect. His reflections were most complex and varied. He imagined his father suddenly receiving the orders of Vladimir and St. Andrew, and how much kinder in consequence he would be today at lesson time, and how he himself, when he grew up, would receive all the orders, and that they would invent one higher than the St. Andrew. As soon as it was invented, he would gain it. A yet higher one would be invented, and he would immediately get that one, too. In these reflections, time passed until the teacher arrived. The lesson on the attributes of time, place, and manner of action had not been learned. The teacher was not only dissatisfied, but also saddened. His sadness touched Sir Etzer. He did not feel guilty for not having learned his lesson, for try as he would, he positively could not do it. While the teacher was explaining, he believed him and seemed to understand, but as soon as he was left alone, he positively could not remember or understand how so short and simple a word as suddenly could be an attribute of the manner of action. But all the same, he was sorry he had grieved his teacher. He chose a moment when the teacher was looking silently into the book.
"Mikhail Ivanovich, when is your birthday?"
he suddenly asked.
"You would do better to think of your work. Birthdays do not signify anything to reasonable beings. It is just a day like any other on which we must work."
Sir Etzer looked attentively at his teacher, at his thin little beard and his spectacles which had slipped down the bridge of his nose, and became so engrossed in thought that he no longer heard what his teacher was explaining. He was aware that the teacher himself did not believe what he was saying. He felt that by the tone in which the words were uttered.
But why have they all agreed to speak in the same way about the dullest and most useless things? Why does he repulse me? Why does he not love me?
He asked himself, sadly, and could find no answer. Chapter 27 After the teacher's lesson, Sir Etzer had a lesson from his father. Before his father came, Sir Etzer sat at the table playing with a pocket knife and thinking. Among his favourite occupations was keeping a lookout for his mother when he went out walking. He did not believe in death in general, and especially not in her death, despite what Lydia Ivanovna had told him and his father had confirmed, and therefore, even after he had been told she was dead, he went on looking for her when on his walks. He imagined that every well-developed and graceful woman with dark hair was his mother. At the sight of any such woman, a feeling of such tenderness awoke in his heart that he grew breathless and tears came to his eyes. He expected that at any moment she would approach and lift her veil. Then he would see her whole face. She would smile, embrace him, and he would smell her peculiar scent, feel the tenderness of her touch, and cry with joy as he had done one evening when he lay at her feet and she tickled him, while he shook with laughter and bit her white hand with the rings on the fingers. Later on, when he accidentally heard from his nurse that she was not dead, and his father and Lydia Ivanovna explained that to him she was dead because she was bad, which he could not at all believe, for he loved her, he continued to look out for and wait for her. There had been a lady with a purple veil in the summer garden today, whom he had watched with a sinking heart as she came toward him along the path. The lady did not come up to them and disappeared somewhere. Today Seretse was more than ever conscious of a flow of love for his mother in his heart, and now as he sat lost in thought waiting for his father, he notched the whole edge of the table with his knife, looking before him with shining eyes and thinking about her. Vasily Lukitch roused him. "Your papa is coming." Seretse jumped up, approached his father, kissed his hand and looked at him attentively, trying to find some sign of his joy at receiving the order of Alexander Nevsky.
"Have you had a nice walk?" asked Karenin, as he sat down in his armchair,
drew toward him an Old Testament, and opened it. Although Karenin had more than once told Seretse that every Christian ought to be well acquainted with Bible history, he often, in Old Testament history, had to consult the book, and Seretse noticed this.
"Yes, Papa, it was very amusing," answered
Seretse, sitting down sideways on his chair and beginning to rock it, which was forbidden.
"I met Nadyenka."
Nadyenka was Lydia Ivanovna's niece, who was being educated at her aunt's house.
"She told me you had received another order, a new one. Are you glad, Papa?"
"First of all, don't rock your chair," said Karenin.
"Secondly, it's not the reward, but the work that is precious. I wish you understood that. You see, if you take pains and learn in order to get a reward, the work will seem hard. But when you work..." Karenin said this, remembering how he had sustained himself that morning by a sense of duty in the dull task of signing 118 papers. "If you love your work, you will find your reward in that." Seretse's eyes, that had been shining with affection and joy, grew dull and drooped under his father's gaze. It was the same long familiar tone in which his father always addressed him, and to which Seretse had already learned to adapt himself. His father always talked to him, Seretse felt, as if he were some imaginary boy out of a book, quite unlike Seretse, and with his father he always tried to pretend to be that boy out of a book.
"You understand me, I hope," said the father.
"Yes, Papa,"
answered the boy, pretending to be that imaginary boy. The lesson consisted in learning by heart some verses from the Gospels and repeating the beginning of the Old Testament. Seretse knew the Gospel verses pretty well, but whilst saying them he became so absorbed in the contemplation of a bone in his father's forehead, which turned very sharply above the temple, that he became confused and put the end of one verse where the same word occurred after the beginning of another. It was evident to Karenin that the boy did not understand what he was saying, and this irritated him. He frowned and began an explanation that Seretse had heard many times already and could never remember because he understood it too clearly, just as he could not remember that the word suddenly was an attribute of the manner of action. Seretse looked at his father with scared eyes and could only think of whether his father would make him repeat what he had just said, as he sometimes did. This thought frightened him so much that he no longer understood anything at all. However, his father did not make him repeat it, but went on to the lesson from the Old Testament. Seretse related the events themselves quite well, but when he had to answer questions as to what some of the events symbolized, he knew nothing about it, though he had been punished before for not knowing this lesson. The part, however, about which he could not say anything at all, but only floundered, cut the table, and rocked his chair, was that about the antediluvian patriarchs. He did not know any of them except Enoch, who was taken up to heaven alive. Previously he had remembered the others' names, but now he had quite forgotten them, chiefly because Enoch was his favourite in the whole Old Testament, and attached to Enoch's being taken up to heaven there was a long string of thought in his head, which now occupied his mind while he looked fixedly at his father's watch-chain and a half-unfastened button of his waistcoat. He did not in the least believe in death, which was so often mentioned to him. He did not believe that people he loved could die, nor, above all, that he himself would die.
That seemed to him quite impossible and incomprehensible. But he was told that everybody would die. He had even asked people whom he trusted, and they all confirmed it. His nurse, too, said so, though reluctantly. But Enoch had not died, so not everybody died. And why should not anybody deserve the same in God's sight and be taken up to heaven alive? Thought Sir Edser. Bad people, that is to say, those he did not like, might die, but the good ones might all be like Enoch.
Well, who were the patriarchs?
Enoch, Enos, but you have already mentioned them.
This is bad, Sir Edser, very bad. If you do not take pains to know what is most necessary for a Christian, then what can interest you? I am displeased with you, and Pyotr Ignatych, this was the chief educationalist, is also displeased with you. I shall have to punish you.
His father and the educationalist were both displeased with Sir Edser, and he really learnt badly. Yet it could not at all be said that he was an incapable boy. On the contrary, he was far more capable than the boys whom the educationalist set before him as models. His father, from his point of view, considered that the boy did not try to learn what he was being taught. As a matter of fact, he could not learn it. He could not, because there were more urgent demands on his soul than those put forward by his father and the educationalist. The two kinds of demands were opposed, and he was in direct conflict with his instructors. He was 9 years old and quite a child, but he knew his soul. It was dear to him, and he guarded it as the eyelid guards the eye, and never let anyone enter his heart without the key of love. His instructors complained that he would not learn, yet his soul was overflowing with longing for knowledge. So he learnt, from Kapitonych, from his nurse, from Nadyenka, and from Vasily Lukich, but not from his teachers. The water which his fathers and the educationalists expected would turn their millwheels had long since leaked out and was working somewhere else. His father punished Sir Edser by not letting him go to see Lydia Ivanovna's niece, Nadyenka. But this punishment turned out luckily for Sir Edser. Vasily Lukich was in good spirits and showed him how to make windmills. He spent all the evening working and dreaming how a windmill could be made on which one could ride, either by seizing one of the sails or by tying oneself to it and spinning round. He did not think about his mother all the evening. But when in bed, he suddenly remembered her and prayed in his own words that tomorrow, on his birthday, she should stop hiding herself and should come to him. Vasily Lukich, do you know for what I've been praying extra?
To learn better?
No.
For toys?
No. You'll never guess. It's lovely, but a secret. When it comes true, I will tell you. You have not guessed?
No, I can't guess. You'd better tell me, said Vasily Lukich, smiling, which he rarely did. Well, lie down, and I'll put out the candle.
But I can see better without a candle what I have been praying for. There, I nearly told you the secret, said Sir Edser with a merry laugh.
When the candle had been taken away, he heard and felt his mother. She stood above him and caressed him with a loving look. But then windmills appeared, and a knife, and all became confused, and he fell asleep.
Chapter 28. When Vronsky and Anna reached Petersburg, they put up at one of the best hotels, Vronsky separately on the first floor, and Anna with the baby, the nurse, and a maid upstairs in a large suite consisting of four rooms. On the day they arrived, Vronsky went to see his brother. There he met his mother, who had come from Moscow on business.
His mother and his sister-in-law received him just as usual, asked him about his trip abroad, and spoke of mutual acquaintances, but did not say a single word about his union with Anna. His brother, however, having come to see him next morning, asked about her, and Alexei Vronsky told him frankly that he regarded his union with her as a marriage, that he hoped to arrange a divorce for her, and would then marry her, and that meanwhile he considered her his wife, just like any other wife, and he asked his brother to say so to their mother and to his own wife.
"If the world does not approve of it, I don't care," said Vronsky. "But if my relatives wish to treat me as a relation, they must adopt a similar attitude toward my wife." The elder brother, who had always respected his younger brother's opinions, was not sure whether he was right or wrong until the world had decided the point. But for his own part, he had nothing against it and went up with Alexei to see Anna. In his brother's presence, Vronsky spoke to Anna merely as to a close acquaintance, as he always did in the presence of a third party. But it was assumed that his brother knew of their relations, and they spoke of Anna's going to Vronsky's estate. Despite all his experience of the world, Vronsky, in the new position in which he found himself, was making a terrible mistake. He might have been expected to understand that society was closed to him and Anna, but some sort of vague notion got into his head that though it used to be so in olden times, yet now, when there was so much progress, without noticing it, he had become an advocate of every kind of progress, public opinion had changed, and it was possible that they would be received in society. Of course, they will not receive her at court, but intimate friends can and should see things the right way, he thought. It is possible to sit for some hours with one's legs doubled up without changing one's position if one knows there is nothing to prevent one's doing so. But if a man knows that he must sit with his legs doubled up, he will get cramp, and his legs will begin to jerk and strain in the direction in which he would like to stretch them. This was what Vronsky experienced with regard to society. Though in the depths of his soul he knew that society was closed to them, he tried whether it would not change and whether it would not receive them. But he very soon noticed that though the great world was open to him personally, it was closed to Anna. As in the game of cat and mouse, the arms that were raised to allow him to get inside the circle were at once lowered to prevent Anna from entering. One of the first Petersburg society ladies he met was his cousin Betsy.
"At last!" she exclaimed joyfully when they met. "And Anna? I am so glad. Where are you staying? I can imagine how dreadful our Petersburg must appear to you after your delightful journey. I can picture to myself your honeymoon in Rome. And the divorce? Is it all arranged?" He noticed that Betsy's delight cooled down when she learnt that Anna had not yet been divorced. "They will throw stones at me, I know," she said, "but I shall come and see Anna." "Yes, I will certainly come. You're not staying here long." And really she came to see Anna that same day. But her manner was very different from what it had formerly been. She was evidently proud of her boldness and wished Anna to appreciate the fidelity of her friendship. She did not stay more than 10 minutes, chattering society gossip, and as she was leaving said, "You have not told me when you will be divorced. Of course, I have kicked over the traces, but others, straight-laced people, will give you the cold shoulder until you get married. And it is so simple nowadays, ça se fait. So, you are leaving on Friday? I am sorry we shan't see one another again." From Betsy's tone, Vronsky might have realized what he had to expect from society. But he made another attempt with his relations. Of his mother he had no hopes. He knew that his mother, who had been so delighted with Anna when she first made her acquaintance, was now merciless toward her for having caused the ruin of her son's career. But he placed great hopes on Varya, his brother's wife. She, he thought, would cast no stones, but would simply and resolutely go and see Anna and receive her at her own house. The day after his arrival, Vronsky called on her, and having found her alone, expressed his wish. "You know how fond I am of you, Alexei," she replied when she had heard him out, "and how ready I am to do anything for you. But I have kept silent because I knew I could be of no use to you and Anna Arkadyevna."
She pronounced the formal Anna Arkadyevna with peculiar precision. Please, don't think I am condemning you. Not at all. Perhaps in her place I should have done the same. I do not and cannot enter into details, she added, looking timidly into his gloomy face. But we must call things by their real names. You wish me to go and see her, and to receive her, and so rehabilitate her in society. But please understand that I cannot do it. I have daughters growing up, and I must move in society for my husband's sake. Suppose I go to see Anna Arkadyevna. She will understand that I cannot ask her to my house, or must do it in such a way that she does not meet those who see things differently. That would offend her. I am not able to raise her.
But I don't consider that she has fallen lower than hundreds of people whom you do receive, said Vronsky, still more gloomily, and rose in silence, having understood that his sister-in-law's determination was final.
Alexei, don't be angry with me. Please understand that it is not my fault, said Varya, looking at him with a timid smile.
I am not angry with you, he said, just as gloomily. But I am doubly pained. I am pained, too, because this breaks our friendship. No, not breaks it, but weakens it. You understand that for me, too, there can be no other course? With those words, he left her.
Vronsky understood that it was vain to make any further attempts, and that they would have to spend those few days in Petersburg as in a strange town, avoiding contact with their former world in order not to lay themselves open to unpleasantnesses and insults which were so painful to him. One of the most disagreeable features of his position in Petersburg was that Karenin seemed to be everywhere, and his name in every mouth. It was impossible to start any conversation without its turning upon Karenin, impossible to go anywhere without meeting him. So, at least, it seemed to Vronsky, as a man with a sore finger feels that he is continually knocking that finger against everything as if on purpose. The stay in Petersburg seemed to him still more trying because he noticed all the time in Anna a new and, to him, incomprehensible mood. At one moment she appeared to be in love with him, and at the next would turn cold, irritable, and impenetrable. Something tormented her, and she hid it from him, appearing not to notice the insults that were poisoning his life, and which should have been still more painful to her with her acuteness of perception.
Chapter 29 One of Anna's reasons for returning to Russia was to see her son. From the day she left Italy, the thought of that meeting did not cease to agitate her. The nearer they came to Petersburg, the greater its joy and importance appeared. She did not ask herself how she should contrive it. It seemed to her natural and simple that she should see her son when she was in the same town with him. But on reaching Petersburg, her present social position presented itself clearly to her, and she realized that it would be difficult to arrange the meeting. She had been in Petersburg 2 days. The thought of her son did not leave her for an instant, but she had not yet seen him. She felt she had not the right to go straight to the house where she might encounter Karenin. Possibly they might even not admit her. It was painful to her even to think of writing to and coming into contact with her husband. She could be calm only when she did not think of him. To meet her son when he was out for a walk, after finding out when and where he went, was not enough. She had been preparing herself so for that meeting, had so much to say to him, and so much wanted to embrace and kiss him. Seretse's old nurse might have helped and advised her, but she was no longer in Karenin's household. In this uncertainty, and in searching for the old nurse, 2 days had gone by. Having heard about Karenin's intimate friendship with the Countess Lydia Ivanovna, Anna on the third day resolved to write her a letter, which cost her much effort, and in which she intentionally mentioned that permission to see her son must depend on her husband's magnanimity. She knew that if that letter were shown to him, he, continuing his magnanimous role, would not refuse her request. The commissionaire who delivered her letter brought back the most cruel and unexpected reply, that there would be no answer. Never had she felt so humiliated as when, having called in the commissionaire, she heard from him the full account of how he had waited, and had then been told that there would be no answer. Anna felt herself humiliated and wounded, but she saw that the Countess Lydia Ivanovna was right from her own point of view. Her grief was the more poignant because she had to bear it alone. She could not share it with Vronsky, and did not wish to. She knew that, though he was the chief cause of her misery, the question of her seeing her son would seem to him quite unimportant. She knew he would never be able to appreciate the depth of her anguish, and that his coldness, if the matter were mentioned, would make her hate him. And she feared that, more than anything else in the world, and therefore hid from him everything concerning her son. Having spent all that day at the hotel, considering how she might see her son, she resolved to write to her husband. She had already composed the letter when she received Lydia Ivanovna's reply. The Countess's silence had made her feel humble, but the letter and what she read between its lines so irritated her, its malevolence seemed so revolting when compared with her passionate and legitimate love for her son, that she became indignant with others and ceased to blame herself. "That coldness, that pretense of feeling," she said to herself. "They want to wound me and torture the child, and shall I submit to them?" "Not on any account. Oh, she is worse than I. Anyhow, I don't lie." And there and then she resolved that next day, Seretse's birthday, she would go straight to her husband's house and would bribe the servants or deceive them, but would at any cost see her son and destroy that monstrous falsehood with which they surrounded the unfortunate child. She drove to a toy shop, purchased a lot of toys, and devised a plan of action. She would go early in the morning, at about 8, when Karenin would certainly not be up. She would have ready in her hand some money to give to the hall porter and the footman in order that they should let her in. Without raising her veil, she would say she had been sent by Seretse's godfather to wish him many happy returns of the day, and that she was to put the toys by his bedside. The only thing she did not prepare was what she would say to her son. Much as she thought about that, she could not prepare the words. Next morning, Anna went alone, and at 8 o'clock got out of the hired carriage and rang the bell at the front door of the house which used to be her home.
"Go and see what it is. It's some lady," said Kapitonich, who was not yet dressed, and in overcoat and galoshes peeped from the window at the veiled lady standing close to the door. His assistant, a lad whom Anna did not know, had hardly opened the door when she entered, and taking a 3-ruble note from her muff, hastily thrust it into his hand.
"Seretse, Sergei Alexeyevich," she said, and walked on.
After examining the note, the porter's assistant stopped her at the inner glass door.
"Whom do you want?" he asked.
She did not hear his words and made no reply. Noticing the stranger's confusion, Kapitonich himself came out, admitted her, and inquired what she wanted.
"I come from Prince Skorodumov to see Sergei Alexeyevich," said she.
"He is not up yet," said the hall porter, carefully scrutinizing her face.
Anna had not foreseen at all that the totally unaltered appearance of the hall of the house where she had lived for 9 years would so deeply affect her. One memory after another, both joyful and painful, rose in her mind, and for a moment she forgot why she had come.
"Would you like to wait?" said Kapitonich, helping her off with her cloak.
Having done so, he glanced again at her face, and, recognizing her, silently bowed low.
"Come in, Your Excellency," he said.
She wished to speak, but her voice refused to utter a sound. With a look of guilty entreaty at the old man, she went with light steps up the stairs. Bending forward and catching the steps with his galoshes, Kapitonich ran after her, trying to overtake her.
The tutor may be there and not yet dressed. I will announce you.
Anna continued to ascend the familiar steps without understanding what the old man was saying.
This way, please. To the left. Please excuse its not being quite clean. He has moved to the old sitting room now, said the hall porter, panting. Allow me. Please, wait a little, Your Excellency. I'll just look in, he said, having overtaken her.
He opened a big door and vanished behind it. Anna paused and waited.
He's only just woken up, said the porter when he came out again.
Just as he spoke, Anna heard the sounds of a child yawning. She recognized her son by the sound of the yawn and pictured him vividly before her.
Let me in. Let me in,
she cried, and entered at the big door. To the right of the door stood a bed on which sat the boy, his nightshirt unbuttoned, bending his little body backward, stretching himself, and finishing his yawn. At the moment when his lips were closing, they extended into a blissful, sleepy smile, and with that smile he again fell slowly and sweetly backwards.
Seretsa?
She whispered, drawing nearer with inaudible steps. During the time they had been parted, and under the influence of that gush of love which she had felt for him of late, she had always imagined him as a little fellow of four, the age when she had loved him best. Now he was not even as she had left him. He was still further removed from the four-year-old child. He had grown still more, and had got thinner.
What did it mean? How thin his face was. How short his hair. How long his arms.
How changed since she had left him.
But still it was he. The slope of the head was his. The lips were his. The soft neck and the broad shoulders. Seretsa, she repeated, just above the child's ear.
He raised himself again on his elbow, moved his tousled head from side to side as if seeking for something, and opened his eyes. Silently and questioningly, he gazed for a few moments at his mother, who stood motionless before him. Then, suddenly smiling blissfully, he closed his heavy eyelids and fell once more, not backwards, but forwards into her arms.
Seretsa, my dear little boy,
she uttered, catching her breath and embracing his plump little body.
Mama,
he muttered, wriggling about in her arms so as to touch them with different parts of his body. Sleepily smiling with closed eyes, he moved his plump hands from the back of his bed to her shoulders, leaning against her and enveloping her in that sweet scent of sleepiness and warmth which only children possess, and began rubbing himself against her neck and shoulder.
I knew, he said, opening his eyes. Today is my birthday. I knew you would come. I'll get up directly.
While saying this, he was again falling asleep. Anna watched him with greedy eyes. She noticed how he had grown and changed during her absence. She recognized, and yet did not quite recognize, his bare legs, now so big, which he had freed from the blanket, and his cheeks, now grown thinner, and the short locks of hair at the back of his head, where she had so often kissed him. She touched it all and could not speak. Tears were choking her.
What are you crying about, Mama?
He asked, now quite awake.
Mama! What are you crying about?
He exclaimed in a fretful voice.
I won't cry. I'm crying for joy. It is so long since I saw you.
I won't,
she said, swallowing her tears and turning away.
But it's
time for you to get dressed, she said, after a pause when she had recovered.